Item six on the agenda. Mr. Huffman is going to start out by telling us whether health care is going to be reformed.
Tomorrow.
I'll be honest with him.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you again. So, item six is the review of the total portfolio performance for the period ending December 31st. We'll get into that in a second. A couple of things I wanted to just share with you before we dig in. First is that August 28th and 29th, we'll be hosting our client summit in San Francisco. Invitations went out via an email blast. If you haven't received yours, please let me know, but I believe everyone was on the list. So you can now go online and register. You'll see that our guest speaker is David Brooks. He'll be our keynote. He's the author of The Road to Character, New York Times columnist, and author of a variety of other books as well. So Road to Character is an interesting book in and of itself, and it kind of takes our discussion up a layer in terms of, you know, we normally engage in all the financial kinds of terms and what's going on in the economy. This kind of takes it to a, you know, a moral compass kind of level, which I think is an interesting way. We also have Cliff Asness, who is one of the founding principals at AQR, is going to be speaking as an external speaker as well, along with maybe another external speaker that we're trying to line up. So the agenda is still coming together a little bit, and we'll have good breakout sessions across a variety of topics. So highly encourage everyone to make the drive over, spend the night at Park 55 if you'd like. There will be a dinner included, and we've organized it so it starts on a Monday afternoon, so you can get in Monday morning if you want. Monday afternoon, dinner, and then Tuesday morning, then wrap up by lunchtime. So hopefully that's convenient for all of your schedules.
We are encouraging the use of public transit, BART.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Walking distance to a BART station, too. It's right there.
Or a segue.
The other thing I wanted to note before we get going is on February 16th, we issued a press release that Verus is selling a portion of its business, which we refer to as strategic partnership, to Goldman Sachs. And this includes Jeff Scott, our current CIO, along with his team that really focuses on what we've called strategic partnerships. It is the outsourced chief investment officer piece of business that we do with several very large clients. And those clients, what we've found is that it's been probably a larger, more work-intensive kind of business than what we initially expected it to be. And because of that and how it fits in with the rest of our business, we looked at that it's probably a better fit in a Goldman Sachs-like institution. There were several bidders for it. Goldman won that bid, and so they agreed to make that acquisition. Deal is expected to close in the course of the next several months. As a result of that, Ian Toner, who I think you've seen before or you've heard at Sackers and on the conference circuit, he is becoming our chief investment officer. And Max Giolitti, who was part of Jeff Scott's team, is staying with us, and he is now our chief risk officer. So we've elevated both of those gentlemen to these positions and think it really fits in better with our existing client base of traditional non-discretionary consulting, our OCIO capability that we're retaining, and the intellectual capital that we've built in conjunction with Jeff Scott and his team over the years. So we'll still have that capability that we can offer clients. And then the risk services that Max heads up is a unique offering that we're working with certain clients now, usually in a general consultant way and helping to shine more risk onto it. In fact, some of what you see in your risk report dashboard is a little bit of that, and other clients have taken it a step further or two. So that's kind of the business going forward. Happy to answer any questions on it. I don't know that I can say a whole lot aside from what was included in the press release, but that's where we stand. And
Ed, are you comfortable personally with the sell-off of this group and the impact on Verus going forward?
Yes. I think the transitions for Max to Chief Risk Officer and Ian to CIO are as natural as it can be. So I think if you've heard Ian speak, he's of that mindset. He's covering all of these things, and it's very natural for him. So that works well. I think what Jeff brought to the table, Jeff Scott, what he brought to the table and his team was a really detailed process that worked well with a certain group of clients. And that group of clients isn't our bread and butter, isn't who we mainly work with. It's not the level of services that you all need. And so it doesn't give me any concern at all for the client base that I work with. So I'm very comfortable with it.
Okay. Any other questions of Ed on this?
Okay. Okay, great. So let's jump into the report now. Thank you for entertaining that brief discussion. So behind tab one, we have our fourth quarter review, which we call our first quarter landscape. And it is a bit dated, so I'll go through it quickly. I'll highlight some of the changes that we've seen since December 31st. And I think we could start on page four to take a look at the slide titled, What Drove the Market in Q4? And a lot of this has to do with the post-election changes. And so in the upper left-hand corner, we have some of the major markets, the S&P 500, 10-year treasuries, and Bloomberg U.S. Dollar Spot Index, so give us a gauge on currencies. And here we see that between November 9th, day after election, and the end of the year, December 30th, we watched the S&P 500 increase by about 3.5%. It's been up over 5% since then. So we've had this nice, quote-unquote, Trump rally going on. 10-year Treasury, coincidentally, sells off. And so we see the yields here rise 2.06%, going to 2.44%. They've since touched 2.6 and are now back down around 2.5-ish. So that all makes sense, this Trump rally taking place. And also the Bloomberg U.S. Dollar Spot Index, a strengthening dollar. We'll talk about that in a moment because that hurts our returns as U.S. investors investing in foreign countries. That dollar dynamic works against us when that happens. Down below that, we have University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey. These numbers have been continuing to tick on very strongly. So here we see December 31st, 98.2, and that's up even since then. So the January and February numbers have continued to tick up. So consumer confidence is very high right now. Nice thing to see, and that's probably indicative of labor markets, indicative of housing markets, indicative of wage increases. All of those things are trending that right direction. And so we've watched this slow, long drama play out since 2009 through current. Continues to play out. Now we seem to be getting to a point where people are actually feeling better about things. The labor market is...
I have a question. What kind of things make that dip? Like on January, as an example, 2012, where are some things that cause it to dip?
Yeah, so it's a survey, and they literally go out and do a phone call survey of people and ask them about their current status and how they view the next 6 months. And so how they view that next 6 months is really soft. And their current status is a little bit built on perception, too. So they're asking about labor. They're asking about the financial stability and how people feel. So it's somewhat of a coincidental indicator of how do I feel right now and my outlook for the next 6 months. So it can change on a whim. And so sometimes it can just be the result of some bad news. You could have, you know, anything from sort of terrorist activity to changing people's tempers and moods to bad labor numbers and jobs reports and things like that. Those kinds of things can really impact it very quickly. So we don't put a lot of stock in that number of saying, okay, it's high, so we feel good about the next 6 months. But it's just interesting to see how strong the consumer feels because they're such a big spender in our economy. So right now they feel good. So we think that that probably helps the spending in our economy and helps it grow. It could change overnight, though.
So when there's a dip, is it how they feel that day with the... Also in 6 months, is there equal mix of that?
Pretty much, yeah. The next section, we have the oil prices. You're probably tracking that. They seem to have reached a bottom. They got up above the $50 mark, down a bit since then. But oil seems to have found a stable place now. And then down below that, we have U.S. tips break even, so some gauge on inflation. And we're showing that at December 31st at 1.95, and that has ticked up. So the February... number for CPI came in at 2.7%. That's a strong, robust number. Now, that came out right before the Fed decided to raise rates again, so that gave them the support they needed to raise rates, along with the rest of the economic picture here in the U.S. So seeing that makes sense. The Fed is now raising rates in response to inflation with an economy that seems to be doing pretty well. Okay, that's the way we want rates to work. That's stable and predictable.
Ed, just a quick question. It shows December 30 is 1.95. Is that 1.95 the yield on a 10-year now being issued TIP together with the inflation protection on principal?
It's the break even between where a 10-year TIPS security is trading and where the 10-year non-TIPS, the 10-year nominal, is trading.
Okay, and that's about 2.5. So we're talking about a 0.55
differential in yield, and that's the value of the, effectively, the inflation protection that the TIP offers?
Essentially. The 10-year Treasury does not have the inflation protection right. built in. So you take that number, then you take the 10-year TIPS, and it has the inflation protection built in. Look at the difference between the yields. On
that's the 0.55 on our my 2.5. Okay, just arbitrary 2.5 on 10-year Treasuries.
The 1.95 is the delta. So right. instead of a 0.55 delta, it's a 1.95 delta. That's how you get the.
So the, it pays out 0.55 in my
right,
model.
Right.
So the yield's 0.55, not 1.95. And the inflation protection component is the 1.95.
No. The 10-year issued giving you a 2.55 nominal strip out 1.95. Or, I'm sorry, add in the 1.95 because it's giving you the inflation protection. So it's actually trading at a higher yield because it's protecting you against inflation. So it's saying the 2.5% on the 10-year
right.
plus 1.95 gives you the TIPS.
Plus or minus?
What's the yield on the TIPS? So pure yield, not ignore inflation for the moment.
Yeah, it would be closer to 4.5. It has to build in the inflation protection.
So that's the combination value. So that's far higher than a 10-year Treasury. Why wouldn't you just buy a TIP?
That's right. They trade like everything else. And so you might look at it on any given day and say, okay, so if that's the case, then I'm getting inflation protection. Do I agree with that inflation protection? So if you look at it and say CPI is actually coming in 2.7, 1.95 is too low, I want more for it, then there would be a sell-off to get that yield back up. So it's going to have its own trading dynamics with it. So if you wanted to just buy and hold and say, okay, I want to lock that in as an inflation-protected investor, you can do that. That's not typically what pension plan does, but other investors have that kind of mindset, so you could do that. But again, it's going to trade up and down, and the TIPS market is going to respond to whatever supply-demand there is based on inflation expectations.
Okay. I'm still not sure I fully understand, but
learn more about it.
I mean, I'm probably belaboring this too much, but TIPS have two components of return.
Right.
Okay, they have the current yield, and they have the inflation protection that is underneath, but you get basically at when the TIP ultimately matures, and assuming inflation doesn't reverse, you don't go into deflation. So you have two different pieces to it. And what I'm trying to do is compare those two pieces to the 10-year Treasury that just has yield and then getting your money back at maturity.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm hearing you describe it, in one case, the value of those two pieces is something for the 10-year in excess of 4, and the 10-year pure Treasury is 2.5. And so that's a fair differential for those two in the marketplace?
That's how the market's pricing it, yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
All right? I had no idea it was that big a spread.
I was told there'd be no math on this test.
I'm feeling like I'm going to...
I'm over belabored this too much now.
No, it's pretty.
It's good to learn that.
Right along. Yeah.
The couple other things that aren't on this page have to do, again, with the consumer and household net worth. I think these are some interesting statistics. As you take a look at household net worth, if you take the U.S. in aggregate, and these are government numbers, so... We think they're accurate. Household net worth in the U.S. is $92.8 trillion. So a big number, hard to get your arms exactly around that. So let's try. Liabilities since 2008 have increased about $500 billion. So the growth in liabilities alone has been about a 3% growth, almost 3.5%. Real estate since 2006, so it goes through 2006, has the trough, comes back up. Real estate is now up $1.5 trillion. So real estate is a net contributor then to net worth. That's a good thing. Financials, all of our holdings in stocks and bonds and bank accounts, have increased $22.3 trillion. And so this is partially driven by the stock market itself of close to $8 trillion, but the rest of it is just people saving money. people being more conservative, people. So you look at it in totality and you say liabilities have increased a little bit, but not much. Savings have increased pretty significantly. People are, you know, A, more risk averse, so I'd rather have less debt on my balance sheet and more in my savings account. And also just that's kind of the growth over time in terms of the markets and what they've given to us. And so being more conservative in that respect is pretty interesting. Now you take it all and you say, okay, so is 92.8 trillion good or bad, a lot or a little? If you divide it by the number of people in the U.S., it's $286,000 per person. And that's increased since about $60,000 per person in 1950, which leads us to about a 2.3% annualized rate. Eh, not that big of a deal. In fact,
Fred, is the money that is parked in savings viewed as money that's on the sidelines that might be invested, or is it is it viewed as the judgment of people that they need to have rainy day to sock away?
It's it is viewed as money that could come into the market, and so we hear a lot of investment personnel point to that statistic and say, right, look, if that comes in, and as people feel better, we expect it to come in. So yes, I think it's also a reflection that we have been over-levered in the past, and we go through these cycles where we'll be over-levered, learn from our lessons, be under-levered, get a little too complacent, and start levering back up again. And so it's interesting. Also, the composition of that leverage changes over time. So mortgage debt might come down, student loans goes up, and I think we're seeing some of that now. Student loans have gone up. Subprime auto lending continues to go up, or auto loans in general continue to go up. So the composition on that side of the balance sheet is also important too.
I saw a stat that auto loans are also now, it's not uncommon to have 7-year loans.
That's right. They're extending out
60 months in 72 months now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the lessons coming out of the housing crisis was that people did not pay off their mortgages, but they did pay off their cars. So go ahead, bank, take my house. But you know what? I need my car to drive.
And they paid their cell phone bill, I'm sure.
Yeah. Probably. I don't have a statistic for that one, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Skip the health care, but I'm keeping my iPhone.
The amount of money somebody has invested in a DB plan, is any of that factored into what they...
No, not until they take the distribution from that DB plan. So if they're going to get a lump sum, it would come out of that. If they're going to just get payments, then only to the extent that they would take that payment and put it in savings rather than spend it. If they can do that, great, but a lot can't.
In other words, debt does not include the unfunded liability of retirement plans.
That's right. That's right. So this is household net worth. If we took a look at, well, you know what? That's a good observation, because even if we took a look at a national statistic of how much U.S. debt there is, and I've seen these charts before, they don't incorporate that piece to it.
And if you built Social Security and Medicare into that under current law, you've got massive additional debt.
You're right. You're right. Against our GDP, that would be a pretty impressive statistic. Yeah, we should do that. Sounds like a Sackers topic. So anyhow, I think what we're seeing in overall, as we take a look at this economic picture, one that's higher growth. So we're looking at a pro-growth agenda. We'll see if it comes to fruition, but higher growth, higher inflation, coincident with that, and stronger U.S. dollar. That's what we saw play out in fourth quarter. It seems to be what we're seeing play out now in first quarter. And I think a lot of it has to do with the actual policies that get implemented versus what people are hearing or what they think they're hearing to be implemented. And as that reality comes to fruition, we might see market sell-offs like we've seen over the past couple of days here in the U.S. If we turn to page 6, we can take a look at some of these numbers. I think we've actually covered all of these because we're showing GDP. GDP annualized 1.7% on this page. The third quarter came in at 3.5, which was very nice. Fourth quarter, the first two readings have come in at 1.9, so they've come down a little bit. Inflation, we talked about. Fed funds rate at 0.5. It's now at about 0.9. So the Fed targets a rate, but then it allows the market to trade within a range. So it's at about 0.9%. So short-term rates have been ticking up here in the U.S. 10-year rate, we mentioned that, 2.5, and unemployment's still at about 4.7, so a nice low unemployment rate.
But thank you for putting in U6, because even though you put it in, you didn't mention it, which is largely what the U.S. media does. They don't mention it.
No, they don't.
They focus on a headline, U3.
Yeah.
And yet it's not counting roughly half the people who are no longer counted and no longer searching for jobs.
Right.
But it's still an impressive number.
And the participation rate, so another way of looking at it, still remains below 63%.
Yeah.
And so that number, as we try to trace that back to pre-financial crisis, when that participation was more like 67, 68%, we still have millions of people not engaged in our labor force compared to where we were. And it's interesting, because then you think about demographics over that long of a time frame. We're now looking at, you know, close to 10 years. Demographics continue to grow at kind of 1% a year. And so total employment is now where we were, thanks to just growth in demographics. But somehow we lost this pocket of people who left the workforce and never rejoined without good explanation of where they went or what they're doing. And what if they got back into the workforce? That would be really good, because that would be even more GDP growth for us, and we're not seeing it yet, you know.
But regardless of the administration, they will always focus on U3. They will not talk about the rest.
Yeah.
I was just curious, because my line of work, when somebody's incarcerated, do they come off of that list somehow, or?
That's a good question. So the reason why they have U3 and U6 is that there are six degradations that the Bureau of Labor Statistics looks at, and each one has a different definition, and they tend to get looser and looser and looser to incorporate a bigger picture. I'm not sure where that cutoff happens. We could find out, though. It's in their definitions.
Jerry blaming the media again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump ahead to page 18, take a look internationally. And certainly a large portion of our portfolio is allocated around the world. This gives us a similar
18.
Yes.
Right. I think Gabe answered your question. It's
U8. U8, that's
former politicians that are still drawing paychecks while they're incarcerated.
Like CEO of Belfort.
That's a different category.
Yeah. Yeah.
Page 18, international economics. So U.S. up at the top for reference. Western Europe, kind of similar position. 1.8% GDP growth, inflation basically tame, but much higher unemployment. And so you're hearing a lot of that come out in the discussions, like in the Netherlands, like in France, where they're having elections, and these are topics that are being front and center. Interesting to see how France plays out. They'll have an election later here in April, and then depending on the results of that, may have another one in May, probably will, with the two top having a face-off in the second election if one of them does not win in April. Japan posting positive economic growth, which is nice to see, because they've certainly had their foot to the floor in terms of stimulus. Inflation very tame, unemployment very low, and Japanese economy has been doing quite well, and some of the equity exposures that we have there have done quite well as well. Unfortunately, the currency effect has negated much of those gains. And then the BRIC nations, the acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and then each of those countries outlined there. A couple things that are interesting is Brazil has gone through and continues to work through its malaise, having impeached its president, getting a new president in place that is working through a number of economic issues, some better than others. So seeing a contraction in GDP, fairly high inflation, fairly high unemployment, other kinds of corruption and black market kind of issues there, and the Brazil equity market rallied. gosh, I remember quoting 40% in the first quarter of last year, and it continued up through the rest of last year. So it's done quite well. Russia, another place that many think is a difficult place to invest, for sure. GDP contraction there, so economic recession, higher inflation, reasonable unemployment, and a 56% growth in the equity markets there over the past year.
Are those real numbers? I'm looking at China and Russia in specifically in asking these this question. There's a lot said about whether you know the veracity of those numbers. Are they real? Are they manicured? What's your take on both Russia and China in terms of these numbers?
They're not real. So China, for example.
You don't trust Russia?
They just hired Fred Douglas. They're going to do great things.
China, for example, issues their GDP number once and never revises it. our statistics go through and have the initial, the second, the third, and then they'll be revised a year later, and then they can even be revised again. And so when we collect our economic growth statistics, it takes us that long to get something that we feel confident in statistically. They issue one number, and that's it forevermore. They use whatever indicators that they have to do that, and a number of the other indicators don't corroborate that number. And in fact, the economic leaders in China use other indicators, things that pick up electricity and energy usage, rail transport, and things of that nature. So they're even looking at it skeptically and saying, yeah, 6.7 looks like the printed number, but we think it's probably less than 5.
So if you had like a little column here that was, you know, the confidence level, these would be low.
They'd be lower than the U.S. for sure, yeah.
Ed, we could certainly buy a geographically limited fund, mm-hmm. I know they're available for India, China,
that's right.
Brazil, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Any sense about how close we bought January 1 and sold December 31, what that return would be relative to what's being described here?
So these are the economic statistics. The actual returns of the markets, like the equity market in Russia, was 56% over that year.
So we would have won. We put a dollar in, we would have gotten $1.56 back at the end of the year,
right,
in that Russia fund.
Right. Right.
Okay. I mean, isn't that for us
pretty amazing?
Really, the real number?
Exactly. Exactly. That is the real number. And so you're paying your emerging market exposure, your emerging market managers to get those exposures or decide to pare back on those. So, you know, let's see. So our last meeting in January and selecting TT and PIMCO help us make those decisions. So I don't think we're at the point where we want to be making individual country calls on it. I think this slide is a good way of saying you sometimes have to invest where the fear is highest, because there are a lot of people working to resolve that fear. If and when successful, the returns are going to be material, and it's going to be before you think it's safe, because the equity markets are forward-looking. So it might look fearful today, but over the next 12 months it looks better, and so you want to capture those kinds of returns. And I think the other point that this slide creates for us is to say economic growth is around the world. So here we're enjoying our 2-3% kind of number, and we hope that that improves. But the real economic engines are in India, are in China, and so we have to be aware of that, and we need to be thinking about how we invest there.
It's also the Warren Buffett model, by the way.
Right.
And when everybody else is fearful, that's when you invest. When everybody else is greedy, that's when you sell it.
Right. Right. We might want to take that into consideration as we look at the U.S. markets. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, too. I saw a pen move. I don't know if you had a question or if there was...
See what?
I saw your pen move. I don't know if you have a question or...
He's bidding on the auction item over there.
Yeah. I do it every once in a while so that no one puts a mirror under my nose. Looks for fog.
Page 20 is something I want to touch on briefly. European banking crisis. The banking crisis that we had here in the U.S. was really solved in a number of ways, one of which being our Fed being really what we called stimulative with quantitative easing and low interest rates, was really designed to reliquidate our banking system, and it did a wonderful job of doing that. And so our bank balance sheets today are quite strong, and the reserves that the banks have on reserve at the Fed is enormous, and so they're in a very strong position. We could see that money start to be lent out, and that would be another source of inflation. We're not seeing that yet, but it has come down a little bit. So our banks here in the U.S. are feeling strong enough that they're drawing down those reserves and saying, rather than get the 25 basis points or 50, whatever the Fed is giving me today, I'd rather lend that out, take some risk by giving it to businesses and consumers, and make a higher return there. And that's good. But as that money gets out into the system, that is a source of inflation, and that's part of this story in the U.S. That's good. We want a banking system to do that. That's their function. We're not seeing that in Europe. And so here we're looking at a chart in the upper right-hand corner that's pretty different. And in fact, that line that peaks out in 2016 that is closing in on 40%, That's Spanish banks. And it's looking at the non-performing loans to their total loan portfolio. So the banks in Spain, basically in aggregate, have 40% of their loans are not performing. They're not getting paid on those loans. And they have to do something about that. And here in the U.S., we took those loans and sold them off. The banks said, you know what? We're not going to deal with that. We'd rather have a clean balance sheet, take a loss, write those down, and sell them off to someone else and let them deal with it, and we'll clean up our system and move forward now. And actually, we've been sort of buyers on that because a lot of pension plans have hired companies like the KKRs or Blackstones of the world to go in and buy those portfolios, those distressed loans, and see them recover. Spain and European banks haven't done that. They've said, you know what, we don't want to recognize that write-down. We don't want to recognize that loss. That makes us look weak. We'll keep that loss on our balance sheet and hope that those loans start to improve and work for it, for them to improve. So because they're taking this different method, it's a longer road to stability than it was here in the U.S. Combined with that, the European Central Bank wasn't as stimulative as the U.S. They waited longer. In fact, they stood and watched Bernanke and company get into quantitative easing and said, we're not going to do that until much later, and then they started doing it. They're still doing it today, whereas we have turned off that feature. So they're still doing it and working through it. You can see here that they still have a ways to go. Right under Spain is Italy, and then below that is Germany and the EU and France, and then below that at the bottom is US. So that gives you some comparison for what we're seeing in terms of the banks.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
Because I'm seeing Spain as the dark green. So is that not Greece that's peaked out at the top?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, and Spain's actually sort of somewhat recovering.
It's still up there, but not.
Greece, like you're right. I have Greece and Spain reversed. And thank you for calling that out.
We need different colors. Those are very similar colors, yeah, even on an iPad.
Are. Probably where my color blindness kicks in. You're right. So it goes Greece, Italy, Spain.
Is Japan, what would it look like if it was there? Because everything I've read about Japanese banks is that they continue to hold huge non-performing loan portfolios.
Trying to think if they mentioned that. I don't think that was mentioned. I don't know.
Curiosity, but.
And I know we're in the international section, but this discussion triggered a question. Do you know if in the Federal Reserve System we still have a reserve requirement where banks are holding what are considered to be excess reserves? Torchlight last year, Chi-Chi was there, I don't remember who else was there, but they made a big deal about the amount of, it was a sizable number, the amount of that was on the sidelines, if you will, that was being held in reserve that hadn't yet been released to the market. And the thought was, you know, there was going to be a lot more runway left because that money hadn't been released yet. And I'm just curious, listening to this discussion, if you know if the same reserve requirements held, and are those money still being held as capital?
Yeah.
So Frank.
Those numbers are in aggregate something like a $200 billion number for U.S. banks. The reserves that were actually held at the Fed were closer to a $2 trillion kind of number. So that $2 trillion has come down over the past year or two, which is indicative of the banks willing to lend it out. So it is very much in play. That money is, there's that much money still on the sideline. Part of that, though, is also due to regulations. And so the needs that are outlined by Basel III requirements, Dodd-Frank, et cetera, are saying banks have to be more conservatively positioned today than they had to be in the past. So part of it is in response to that. And then the election of the Trump administration is now changing that, saying, wait a minute, now we have a bank-friendly president in the White House. We expect that dialogue to change on Dodd-Frank, and that dialogue has changed Basel III. So Basel III is international accord for banking industry, and even those discussions are now changing and often delayed. I think there was last week where a meeting was delayed or postponed another couple of weeks because they couldn't get the right people at the table to agree on what that next step is. So the regulation pendulum is really starting to turn the other way now. Banks, as a result, their stocks are up 60% over the one-year period ending February 28th here in the U.S. So that's some indicator of what we're seeing.
I'd say.
Yeah.
Thank you.
They gave some of that back yesterday.
Yeah, that's true.
One question, it's an important question. You said you're colorblind?
I think there's like a 12-point colorblind test. I'm colorblind on one of them.
I'm only concerned about one. You can differentiate between red and black, correct?
Red and black.
Call yourself a trustee.
Yes, I'm just trying to. Want somebody sitting next to him if he has problems with those two colors.
Yeah, that's why I could never become a fighter pilot. 27, let's take a quick look at the equity environment. Here, I wanted to point out about the currency effect, because as we take a look around the world, for a long time we've been looking at our research and saying, gosh, things look a little bit pricey, or at least fully valued here in the U.S. Should we be looking at other countries to invest in? And we've been saying, yes, we should. And so here we take a look at quarterly, year-to-date, and one-year returns. Year-to-date and 1 year at the same time frame in this case, because it's the end of the year. But taking a look at these returns in local versus as a U.S. investor. And so when we have the column unhedged, that's as the U.S. investor. When we have the term as hedged, meaning we've hedged out the currency risk, that's as a local investor, as if we were in Japan or in the UK or in the Eurozone, what our returns would be. And they're pretty different here. And so we take a look at international large cap for the quarter, down 0.7% on an unhedged basis. So that's what we got. On a hedged basis, 7.3%. Eurozone, similar story, 3.2% positive as a US investor. But had we hedged it out, 10.3%. And same going down through this column. Japan, certainly notable, 1.2% local, or 1.2% as US, 16% as local. And we say, okay, so what do we do about this, and why haven't we thought about this before, and what's going on here? Currency for the longest time has been a tailwind for us as US investors. The dollar had been weakening. And that allows us to export more effectively. We pay more for imports, but that's okay. We've been a strong economy for much of the past several decades, so we've been okay with that. And the equity markets have therefore just been kind of giving us currency return. And no one's ever asked the question, because when returns are good, you never ask the questions. Now that the wind is changing and it's becoming a headwind to us, wow, let's take a look at this and let's think about our portfolio and what kind of currency exposures we have. And so this is kind of highlighting some of that in terms of our exposures. We'll take a look at them individually in a moment. But we are facing currency headwinds. And so our research is taking a look at that and saying, well, what can we do about it? Because even once you recognize the problem, that doesn't mean we have an implementable solution. So we recognize the problem, and then we say, okay, for a particular client and what our exposures are here in this portfolio, what can we do about it? Can we talk to our investment managers and see if they have a solution to offer? Can we find currency providers and see if they have a solution to offer? Do we just accept it because that's the way we model it into our asset allocation? And yeah, sometimes that works for us, sometimes it works against us. Maybe we just continue to accept it. So we have some more research pieces coming out to address these more specifically. And we continue to look for currency solutions that are cheap and implementable. They aren't always cheap. And so sometimes what we're looking at is like, yeah, that provides us a benefit, but once you take all the costs into account, we're not seeing a real viable solution there long term. So, we'll
how do you on that question? I was just looking today. The euro against the dollar is $1.08. Pound is $1.24, $1.25, and it was it got as low as $1.19 and bounced around and has come back a little bit. But how do you hedge currency risk in an environment like with the Brexit overlay, where you don't really know what's going to happen? And that's a long-term unknown, right? Like the two-year Article 50 process could take any number of turns. How would you, I don't understand what structure you'd use to try to hedge the currency risk?
Oh, so there are currency markets specifically. So it's a combination. It's a futures market, and so you use futures contracts that are traded among parties with specific dates. So part of the expense is saying, okay, if I want to hedge out my currency for the next month or 2 months or 3 months, I'll enter into a contract that locks in today's exchange rate for a period of the next 3 months. So regardless of what happens at the end of those 3 months, that contract would settle, and then a gain or loss would be recognized. So if you're the buyer of that contract at today's spot price, you've locked it in. Now if the currency moves against you, you get compensated for that to exactly offset what you had versus what you have then versus right. What you had at the beginning. So now it's a futures market. As long-term investors, as a pension plan, you go into it and say, well, we're kind of perpetual investors. And because we're perpetual investors, once that contract is about to mature, we enter into a new one and sell off that one. So we're always taking out new futures contracts. That's part of what drives the expense up, is that you always have to be investing in new futures contracts.
Ed, these contracts are between a party and a counterparty. They're a pure bet on each side. That one side wins and one side loses when you get to the end of the contract.
So that would be a description of a forward contract, where you're entering into the contract with a counterparty, so you and I could set up that. With a futures contract, it's an exchange-traded vehicle. So yes, there are buyers and sellers of those futures contracts that will set the price for it, but you and I wouldn't transact with each other. We would transact through an exchange, and that exchange would ensure that the contract is good. So if the concern is that currencies might move so far that I'm not able to fulfill my obligation anymore and the contract I entered into is broken, then the exchange is there to facilitate that and ensure reserves are in place to protect.
I guess part of what I was just trying to get a comfort for, airlines, Southwest, used to hedge the price of gasoline.
That's right.
And so, I mean, that's a very tangible. We will buy in 6 months so many gallons at such and such a price. And then the other side of the contract on that agrees to deliver that. These there's nothing other than a winner and a loser, I'm assuming. I didn't phrase it very well, but that was intended to be a question.
That's right. It's kind of a paper loss or a paper gain.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody's delivering something.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. It's settled based on the net difference between the contract price. You don't actually have to deliver 100 million pounds or $100 million. You just recognize the difference between that pound-dollar trade, and that's how you settle it.
And the exchange effectively guarantees the financial solvency and integrity of the parties.
That's right.
Okay. That's
right. I'm just trying to figure out how we get the 16.1%. or the 10.3% hedged return. Those are sizable differentials.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm just trying to appreciate the process by which that's accomplished. It's not. Sounds like it's not for the meek.
Right. So, or perhaps investing in Japan isn't for the meek. I don't know. So, when you invest, if we were to just do an isolated investment in Japan, we effectively have to sell our dollars, buy yen, buy the stocks,
right?
Own the stocks, sell the stocks, take the yen, convert it back to dollars. Essentially, we're doing that right. When we invest in Japan. And what this does is basically says, okay, complement that decision with the contract to enter into a 1 year or one quarter Japanese yen US dollar hedge. And so we're going to agree upon it on October 1st or September 30th, lock in that exchange rate, and then that will be the exchange rate that applies throughout the entirety of our investment. Instead, because we get out of the dollar and buy the yen, now we're exposed to what happens to the Japanese yen-dollar trade at December 31st.
And it sounds like these return numbers are gross of fees, because you mentioned the transaction cost associated with playing that futures game, right, in terms of hedging the currency risk. So there's a real cost to that.
That's right.
So the, that 16.1% is probably lower.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Because these are just benchmark index. You actually can't invest in that benchmark index without paying some transaction costs. That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Actual realized would be lower.
So one positive note I want to bring up in this conversation here. Our strategic asset allocation has put a material overweight to international and emerging market mandates relative to the U.S. market. So we're going through a rotation right now of selling U.S. equities, buying into these markets. So Ed's bringing up a point here of saying when we buy the package deal, we buy the currency and the economic exposure. And that currency is having a material impact on the U.S. dollar returns. But keep in mind, we're still building exposures here, so we're taking strong dollar exposures, selling them off, and coming in at relatively inexpensive currency positions here. So I think that rotation may be very advantageous for us in today's environment. Selling U.S. equities, buying emerging market equities, we're getting a good entry point on the currency side of the equation.
So this was the old use California income to buy Montana property.
There you go.
Same thing. Okay. Except Montana's gone up now.
Okay, let's wrap it up on page 41. Take a quick look at the S&P 500. Some really interesting things here in the U.S. I wanted to highlight. Aside from the banks having the big rally that they've had, this page does show financials in general having a really strong fourth quarter. So financials are more than just banks. That's also insurance companies and asset managers, and used to include real estate. That's been broken out now. But you're seeing that have a strong quarter, 21%, followed by energy. So energy is interesting as the oil has found its price. The energy stocks, the equity of these companies, has had a positive return, and so that very much has the forward-looking component to it. So year-over-year earnings for the energy producers is down 82% in the fourth quarter. So they've lost a lot of money. They're kind of now down to zero. They made about $8 billion in new earnings. Projected for the rest of 2017 is about 47, call it $50 billion in earnings. So they're going to come from $8 to $50 billion. People are recognizing that, saying, that's a big material increase, so seeing a return in the equity stocks isn't so surprising. And then the rest of the sectors there are not quite as exciting. The fourth quarter earnings are now in, and as we've gone through the earnings cycle in January, February, some interesting numbers come out here. So going into the quarter, we expected, the market expected, that earnings would go up about 3% year over year. So fourth quarter earnings would be about 3% higher than they were fourth quarter of 2015. So 3% growth, that's nice. They actually came in closer to 4.9%. So 3%. And all of the CEOs out there tried to downplay it, and then they beat expectations, and they beat them by 2%, and so in aggregate, lo and behold, the estimate was 3, and the actual was 5, okay. And 65% of the companies beat earnings, 53% beat on sales, and now we're sitting here at the kind of lofty levels that we're at, and we see that the Case-Shiller PE ratio is now at a 15-year high. We see that the forward-looking PE measure is about 17.5, 17.7, somewhere in that range. That's high on a relative basis. And so when you take a look at the U.S. equity market, you say, okay, feeling a little bit rich, at least fully valued. We've had a nice run. Let's see how things continue. But by the way, what do earnings look like going forward? Maybe we should be thinking about that a little bit. Earnings expectations for first quarter, what we're in right now, are that earnings are going to increase over 9%. This quarter alone, and that's a year-over-year comparison, so compared to the first quarter of 2016. So 9%, that's pretty good earnings growth, and we're expecting revenues to increase 7.4%. So we're expecting a pretty strong first quarter from the S&P 500 companies. How about calendar year 2017? We're expecting 10% earnings growth over calendar year. So this is interesting to me, because I look at it and say, okay, so we're expecting 9% in the first quarter and 10% over the first year? Maybe I should just stay invested through the first quarter and then sell out and wait for everything to settle, because that doesn't sound like a very exciting market to be in. How about from a revenue perspective? We're expecting 7.4% growth in the first quarter, all of calendar 2017, 3.3%. So you're telling me I'm expecting revenues to go down in the next three quarters. So these are analyst expectations, and analysts are looking at the companies and doing the research, and their analyst estimates change and everything. So we always have to take them with a grain of salt, but that's an interesting picture to paint. And so when we look at international issues and we say, looks like troubles, not sure I want to invest there. U.S. feeling really good because markets are up, everything is really great, we have high expectations for the future. But when we look at the valuations now, it's kind of hard to say, and this is where we want to have our strategic overweight to the U.S. So I think our portfolio is pretty well positioned, long story short. We're pulling back on U.S. and increasing international exposure. We're thinking more about that currency dynamic, and we'll have more discussions about that in the future. But this is kind of the outline of what we're seeing right now. So planting some seeds for the future, and I think our portfolio is positioned well against that backdrop. Page 42 has the index returns. I think here in the U.S., as we take a look in the upper left-hand corner, we're seeing positive numbers 3, 4, 5%, as high as 14% for the small cap value space at the bottom. In the lower left-hand corner, international equities is seeing some pullback, largely again due to currency. Upper right-hand corner, fixed income markets, roughly flat except for the BC US Treasury long. That's come off pretty significantly. So long-dated treasuries had a sell-off there in the quarter, but still maintained a positive return for the year-to-date. And then down below, some other indices about commodities, emerging market debt, hedge funds, and currencies. And there you can see at the bottom the yen getting a negative 13% for the quarter, so it helps tie back to.
Would you spend a moment on BBG BARC U.S. Corp High Yield? That's so dramatically different on the fixed income upper right-hand block.
I'm sorry.
It's John, third from the bottom.
The issuer.
The issuer, exactly.
The U.S. high yield.
You're talking about the
drop down to issuer and drop down to second one.
Okay.
It's a U.S. high yield, month 1.8, quarter to date 1.8, year to date 17.1.
Yes.
Okay, and then compare that to all the other year-to-dates, and it's dramatically different.
It is. So high yield is interesting because it trades a lot like stock in that it's almost as risky. So here we're talking about the bonds of companies that are rated below BBB. So the rating agencies are saying these are riskier investments, and riskier investments should generate a higher return for us. But what they're saying, what we're seeing here in this year-to-date number of 17% is basically that those riskier companies continue to benefit from a stronger economy overall. So you take that pool of riskier companies in an economic economic context that is doing better, and the risk that they're facing is something that they're able to work through. And so what we've seen then is that the credit spreads for high-yield companies have come off pretty significantly, kind of back to all-time lows, not quite all-time lows, but they've come in really quite tight. And so we're now looking at this and saying probably back off high yield a bit, if that's within your
question. And there is a very sharp demarcation within the issuers in the high yield space. I think the traditional issuers haven't moved dramatically, but about a quarter of the high yield index energy. And take a look at 41, who's the top performing sector in the S&P 500 for the year? Energy. Stocks were up. High yield spreads came way in on the energy issues there. That really wags the dog on the high yield index.
That's true. They were being priced for default.
Yep.
And when they didn't actually default.
Yeah.
And credit spread, just be clear, as contrasted to interest rate risk, is the spread on sense of default, market's view of the likelihood of default.
That's
so
right.
You're saying that's basically gone down to where that spread is minimal,
right,
relative to where credit rating is above double B.
Yes. Thank you. So throwing around jargon loosely, spread being the difference between what that high yield instrument is yielding and what a comparable U.S. Treasury is yielding, that's the spread between those two yields. And yes, it is indicative of default rates and risk implied by that. by that sector. So if there are no further questions, we can move on to a review of the portfolio. Certainly happy to entertain any questions. All right, let's jump to tab two. Turning to page two here, taking a look at the portfolio, starting the quarter at $7.6 billion, seeing net cash outflows not entirely offset by investment change, but investment change was positive, so pending market value of $7.5 billion change. Pages three and four give us an indicator of, or a view of, the market value history and the asset allocation history on three, and then page four, having us check the boxes to make sure we're in line with our investment policy and the resolution that we drafted. So the top table on the right-hand side of page four gives us our current allocation as compared to our long-term target, which is the FFP four-year allocation. And then the chart table below that against current targets, which are the phase one targets. And you can see that the current allocation is very much in line with the phase one targets. Modest overweights and underweights, primarily due to market positioning, market movements. So everything checks out there nicely. Pages five and six give us a view of our performance relative to peers. So some comparable numbers here. This is gross of fees, which is how we compare ourselves against peers, also on a gross of fees basis. So it gives us an apples to apples comparison that way. Total fund registering a positive 0.5%. for the quarter and a positive 7.4% for the year. So over the calendar year, in excess of the actuarial assumed rate, which is good. But below policy index for the year to date and slightly above for the quarter. And as we look down the column for the quarter, we're seeing that we have underperformance in domestic equity. We'll talk about that in a minute, as well as international equity and global equity. And then outperformance in domestic fixed income and high yield, inflation hedge, and real estate. Alternatives also modestly underperforming there. Three-year number is 6.1. Five-year number, 9.7. That's pretty impressive. A lot of strong equity returns built into that. 10-year number still incorporates some of that global financial crisis, being that this goes back through the beginning or the end of 2006. So it'll be interesting to see how those numbers roll off. That 10-year number will start ticking up. Pages 7 and 8 giving us a similar picture on a net of fees basis. Page 9, page I think that's most useful to any board when looking at the plan. This is 5 years. And taking a look at total fund generating annualized return of 9.7% with an annualized standard deviation of 5.5%. This is kind of unbelievably good numbers. If you move over a few columns to Sharpe ratio, 1.75%, that's quite high. The asset allocation last we did with you has a target of a return of closer to 7% with an expected standard deviation of about 12%. So we've been enjoying higher returns and lower standard deviation, a very nice combination. And our Sharpe ratio, we'd probably expect that to be closer to 0.5. In fact, we'll take a look at the asset allocation work in a moment because we have an update for you. So we'll take a look at that momentarily. But I think this is the best page that helps tie back asset allocation work and how we have that done annually or deeper dive once every 3 or 5 years with asset liability studies. How are we actually doing? This is the performance piece that helps us actually see that. Are we getting what we thought we were getting in totality?
Ed, do you have any broad view of how we're comparing? You do read frequently about PERS. And I realize that the time frames are different, but their results have been terrible compared to this. How are 37 ACT plans in a similar size, Sacramento, Alameda, San Bernardino, how they're comparing to what we've done here?
I think you're comparing very favorably to them. So you enjoy some very strong returns with lower risk. So I think you're doing quite well.
Is that because we have an outstanding board or outstanding advisors?
I haven't say board.
John, I think it's both.
Good answer, good answer.
Might just be something in the water.
We got lucky.
Pages 10, 11, and 12 take us through the individual strategies. I'll comment on just a few of them.
One question.
Yes,
Jackson
sir.
Square, what are we going to do anything with that?
Yep. So we're going to hit Jackson Square. Might as well hit that one first off. So you're seeing the 96th percentile for the quarter. Their 1 year has been really challenging. And most of their longer-term performance is really driven by this past year. So you look at the 3 and 5 and 10, and those have both the absolute, the relative, and the rankings have all come down. Please keep in mind, though, that every time we look at those time frames, that 1 year is actually being triple counted. It is also a factor in the 3, the 5, and the 10. So that 1 year has really been to their detriment. We talked before, we've heard from them about the Valiant exposure and how much it hurt performance. And so that is certainly one cause. This current quarter, they're now out of Valiant. This current quarter, they had stock selection in IT and consumer discretionary that hurt them. Overweight healthcare, underweight industrials. So everything that really benefited from the Trump rally was not what they were in. And so that's been a hurt. They also specifically hurt by TripAdvisor, eBay, Biogen, and Nielsen Holdings. It's a stock picker strategy. It's a very concentrated portfolio, 30 to 40 names kind of in it. It's very concentrated, and how each of those individual names is going to dictate their outcome. Long term, we probably look at this in combination with the asset allocation work that we're doing and thinking about how that domestic equity exposure gets repositioned. And so as we think about those bigger building block issues, I think things like Jackson Square will be resolved. So my recommendation today wouldn't be to make any changes to that strategy. In fact, given the cyclicality of their performance, probably wait it out a little bit longer. And if
how much longer would you wait it out?
They look at their strategy as saying a business cycle, so a five-year kind of business cycle. And as we take a look at this performance, you have the individual calendar years. So they were doing okay in 2012, 13, 14, 15 even on a relative basis, 16 as a trough. And so we'd expect to see that trough probably continue a little bit longer and then start to improve. So I could
see
that.
So this is 17. What do you want to wait till 20?
No, because I think the bigger picture of the asset allocation will guide that decision, and that will be a bigger impact than whether or not we make any individual manager change. So we'll be moving a bigger portion of the portfolio with domestic equity changes than we will with individual managers within domestic equity. And because of that, I would think that we take action on this strategy sooner.
Ed, just as an aside, Ackerman was described in the journal, I think in the last week, as having sold all of his Valiant.
Oh, really?
Just as one item of interest.
Right. Yeah, I saw that.
I did not see that one. That's good. Yeah. I'll have to find that. I wonder when he got in and got out, because that has been a volatile stock. So
yes, it is.
Yeah. He may have made money on that trade. I'm not sure. Moving up a couple lines above that, we have Intech. It had a difficult quarter, 89th percentile. Still strong 3 and 5 year. So it had about a 5% underweight to financials. And you saw how strong financials were, generating 20% in the quarter. Being 5% underweight to that is a pretty big cause for underperformance. In fact, I think you're going to see that trend throughout a lot of these equity strategies, being underweight financials, because heading into fourth quarter, financials didn't look like the place you wanted to be in. Banks, as an example, were looking like they were challenged. Stress tests were saying banks go out and raise more capital. And with the change in to the Trump administration and changing the international dialogue on regulation, those all rallying catches a lot of investment managers saying, whoa, we were underweight financials for the very reason we thought it was prudent. We weren't expecting that. Yeah. So. Towards the bottom, we have Ceradex, also ranking bottom decile for the quarter. You can see their longer-term performance numbers are just fine, certainly on a relative basis and exceeding the benchmark. So they were overweight consumer discretionary and had some stock selection there, again, underweight financials. But their process hasn't changed and doesn't give us much cause for concern. A couple lines below that, we have Pureford.
Yeah. They had a rough go.
So 15% underweight to Japan.
What We're still new with them, though, right? I mean...
We are.
So we got to ride a little bit.
That's right. That's right. So 15% underweight to Japan and had some stock selection in UK and Europe. Also underweight financials by 13%. William Blair outperformed, did so nicely. I think the next one I want to mention is on page 11, the top artisan partners underperforming there. 3-year number still looks terrific. So again, 9% underweight to financials here. 16% overweight to technology. Technology didn't have a great quarter internationally.
Hey, Ed, a question. Sir? On something I peer for, do we hear from them, or maybe this question is really for Tim. Do we hear from those guys in turn, you know, you have this kind of a quarter?
Yeah, I'm actually meeting with them next week as well.
Okay. I was just assuming, maybe it's a dumb question, but I'm just figuring if you have this kind of a rough go, you know. So well,
regardless of performance, we're touching base with all of our managers at least every 6 months. The vast majority, you know, far more frequently than that.
Okay. I appreciate that.
And the investment managers tend to be very proactive, so we typically get the statement of the holdings, we get an attribution report, we get a commentary, and so it gives us some view on their outlook, gives us some view on what happened over the quarter and why they did what they did. So they're usually very proactive about that, both in good months and bad months, good quarters, bad quarters.
So you have to separate spin from reality, right?
Yeah. Why we make the big bucks.
There you go.
There's a little spin back. Yeah. Moving into domestic fixed income, we see our liquidity portfolio now being reflected here. These strategies were funded in November, so we don't have quarterly data just yet. We will next quarter. But you're now seeing the presence of the DFA short credit, Insight, and SIT short duration strategies here. And then AFL-CIO performing very much in line with benchmark. Here on the high yield side on page 12 at the top, we have the Allianz position. Modest outperformance there, slightly shorter duration. So with the change in rates, that helped them. And also agency multifamily mortgage-backed securities helped. Wellington underperforming and having a little bit of a history of underperforming here. We will note that we're working with Tim and staff on the risk diversifying portfolios. So in this functionally focused portfolio, the three tiers being liquidity, growth, and risk diversifying. We would think of this as a strategy in the risk diversifying bucket, and we're looking at how we can best create the risk diversifying bucket to offset the risks embedded in the growth portfolio. So we do anticipate changes here as well in the future. So more to come. For now, I do want to highlight that this strategy lost a client in the first quarter that had about $330 million invested. And that's pretty material because that brings the strategy down to $870 million. So Wellington has affirmed that there won't be any changes to the personnel and what have you. The firm is still strong. They're keeping the same people in place. The people are managing other strategies, so this isn't their sole source of income. So that is good. But, you know, looking at the underperformance and thinking about what we want to do with the risk diversifying portfolio in general, we would anticipate some changes here down the road. And then real estate, Adelante, slightly underperforming the Wilshire REIT index there for the quarter. Longer-term numbers in line with the index. Pages 15 and 16 and 17 giving us a view on the private strategies, the closed-end funds we're committed to across fixed income, inflation, opportunistic, real estate, and private equity, taking a look at how they're all being funded and continuing to build this portfolio. And then pages 18 and 19 giving us the IRRs, the internal rate of returns, gross and net basis for us, so strategy by strategy. I don't know that there's anything particularly noteworthy here to share, or Tim, if you have any notes on any of these strategies. I think they're continuing on as expected. Some better than others, but... And then page 22 and 23 giving us a look at the fee structures and ensuring everything checks out as expected. And so no surprises there.
I have a question.
Sorry. Yes, you didn't need to jump ahead.
Tim, Bay Area Equity Fund,
I'm taxing my memory, but my memory is telling me that we're not going to be involved with them with anything anymore. Is that still the... And are they still in business?
I mean, they're still in business. So they raised funds three years under the new partnership structure. They brought new people. Some people have departed. They brought in a new partner there. It's got a little bit different bent to it. But they do have a fund three. They changed the name of the partnership. I can't recall. It's something similar. But we opted not to pursue that based upon, you know, kind of the status of the relationship at that point in time and the fact that we couldn't deploy a lot of capital with them. So I think that remains kind of the going in mentality. Now, we are, you know, we're in the midst of a very long, protracted search for a private markets advisor. Certainly the private markets advisor is going to have some input on that. We're getting close to the end of that process.
Are they still in, and correct me if I'm really taxing my memory, but are they still in apartments and low-income housing and putting together that kind of those kind of deals? Were they in that?
No, this is venture capital focused. So this was focused on, this had Fund One had a large position in Tesla and Pandora and that sort of thing.
Okay.
They don't do any real estate. They reinvest in more income areas in the Bay Area.
That's what I'm.
Yeah, but it's not in housing per se. It's they want a bias towards industries that are located in economically depressed areas in the Bay Area. Okay.
Thank you.
That's DBL. So this is DBL. That's the entity. The All fund right. is Bay Area Equity Fund.
All right.
Tim, could you just touch base on page 17, or 16, I'm sorry, on Hearthstone? It's almost 10 years old. It's like 80% called. There's still an outstanding possibility. But it lists a $7,600 market value. I'm just having trouble tying all those numbers together.
Yeah, Hearthstone is, we had Hearthstone 1 and Hearthstone 2. Hearthstone 1 finally wrapped up. Hearthstone 2 is, for all intents and purposes, it's done. We have contingent liabilities and contingent assets. Our expectation is you could essentially zero this out, and that would be our baseline expectation. We're not sending any money over.
Right.
The remaining commitment will never be called.
Okay, so I mean that's what I'm asking. Does that commitment still hang out there? And you just answered the answer is no. They couldn't call it?
There is a very small possibility. We, in a conversation with them, it's not going to happen. There's an accounting methodology to getting everything wrapped up and off the books here. And I think we're looking at another 3 years to actually zero this thing out.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's going to get the Nogales Award.
Yes.
Really?
Nogales
will be wrapped up this year.
Nogales may get the Hearthstone Award.
Nogales get the Hearthstone Award, yeah.
Our goal is to get rid of all of those legacy tiny positions, but whatever happens there, there's no material impact left to be had from that investment.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Could we have some kind of a category that combined all those into small, hard to get rid of, de minimis
dogs and cats,
children,
as a single item.
We're never going to have that again. Once Hearthstone goes away, we're never going to have that again.
We won't need that category.
We've got the recorder on, right?
We'll call that section of the report the kennel, right?
There you go.
All the dogs. Pretty small group, actually.
I had one other manager note. Sorry for skipping around. Ceradex. December 16th, Virtus Investment Partners. This is spelled V-I-R-T-U-S.
Yeah, not you.
Not us, and not Virtus, the V-E-R-T-I-S. V-I-R-T-U-S Investment Partners announced that they are acquiring Ridgeworth Investments, which is the parent of Ceradex. Organizational change there. We don't anticipate any changes to Ceradex. And Ridgeworth was owned by a private equity firm, whereas Virtus is publicly traded. So it actually takes away that instability of being a private equity-owned portfolio company, which I think we view favorably. So wanted to make note of that as well. Maybe Tim had already at a prior meeting. But okay. So that's tab two, unless there are any questions on the Investment Performance Report. Tab 3 has the risk dashboard. And so a couple things I wanted to note with regards to the risk dashboard. When we take a look at page 1, everything checks out very much in line with what our expectations would be. So here we have the current portfolio in this first column of dials with the phase 1 targets in the middle column of dials. And as you compare those, you can see that our portfolio risk is 8.1 versus phase 1 targets of an 8.0. So that's a volatility metric. So we are just slightly overweight volatility here. 8.1 versus 8 gives us about a 1.4 difference, or 1.4% overweight volatility. Equity beta, exactly in line. Interest rate, duration risk, exactly in line. And credit risk, exactly in line. So those all check out.
In line, but very different than the average pension.
That's right. And that's a good point, because as we develop these phase one targets, we're in a transitory period towards getting to our long-term goals, which, again, will look different than the average pension because we're taking a different approach here.
Right, okay. But that's a reflection of the different approach.
Correct.
Quite dramatic reflection of it.
Okay, correct. Page 5 just gives us, and 6, gives us the same information in table form or chart form about our relative overweights and underweights. And I think the real meat of this report is charts 7, 8, and 9. 7 basically says, if we took a look at our asset classes and grouped them into these 6 categories, where would it look like our exposure is? So again, this total portfolio risk, we're just a smidge overweight total portfolio risk, with the bulk of that being an overweight to inflation, offset by underweight to equity and credit. So this is basically saying, take a look at our asset classes and just group them by these factors: equity risk, rates, interest rates, credit, inflation, and hedge fund risk. And currently we don't have any hedge funds, so that's 0. Chart 8 says, okay, well, what if we took the benchmarks and decomposed them into factors, rather than take the whole benchmark and slot it as a credit exposure or an equity exposure? Take a look at the factors embedded in that index, do that for all of the indexes we have exposure to, and then reconfigure the portfolio based on that. Where do our exposures lie then? And this is interesting, because now we see a dramatic underweight to inflation. So from an asset allocation perspective, we're overweight to inflation. From an actual economic exposure perspective, we're underweight inflation. And charts 8 and 9 do the same thing, really. One is basically saying, show me the relative weights as compared to my policy target. 9 is saying, show me how they sum up to the total. And so chart 9, I think, is indicative of saying, okay, we're underweight inflation, we're overweight equity. Given where we're seeing the markets, that has made a lot of sense, because inflation has been very tame. Equities have been doing very well. We like to have those relative overweight underweights. Now we might look at it a little bit differently and say, well, inflation seems to be ticking up. Is this still what we want to do? So that's what this report tells us. The next pages go into more detail on all of that. But basically 7, 8, and 9 give us the picture. So Tim and I were talking about how best can this be used by the board, and is this helpful to you? And we're not ready to start managing the portfolio in this kind of way, so it's kind of shedding a different light on things. But right now it's almost more conversational than really mechanical or instrumental in changing any of our decisions. And so what we'd like to do is take some time in the summer probably and start to build out more education around this, and start customizing it more to the plan, and thinking about how we use this through these transitory phases and how we want about think about using it long term. We think it's definitely of value, because when you look at your portfolio like this, it kind of gets you to step away from individual managers being overweight or underweight financials or technology or consumer discretionary or something, and helps us think big picture about where do our exposures lie. And if these are the real drivers of what's going on in the economy and the real drivers of what's happening in our portfolio, and if we want to think about how those might tie to the liabilities of our plan, we might think about this differently. We might want to create some tools and mechanisms so we can use this in a different way. So something we can think about for the future. Yes, sir?
On the equity, do you split that out from U.S. versus international, because you were talking about cutting back on U.S. and building more international?
And if you split out that equity bar, would you see U.S. much farther out, our exposure versus?
So, I mean, you can talk about this, but it's basically an aggregated big factor. So it's not U.S. equities, international equities, it's equity as a factor, as a driver of overall returns.
That's right. And the way we break it out is to have currency as its own bucket. So you see down there towards the bottom, the currency has its own slot. So now you can start thinking about that equities being tied to economic growth globally. Yeah, we could break it out in different sectors and such and geographies. But in general, thinking about how much equity exposure is really the key determinant. And then if you have the currency exposure separate, that combined gives you that international flavor. So
when we look at something like this, and you think about changing the funds,
right,
investment process in different, are you talking about small change, large change? Because I mean I see us long-term investors, this looks to me or feels to me like maybe we're becoming trying to manipulate the system or moving really quickly, and what's the word? What's the two types of investments?
Tactical,
active and passive.
Active and passive. It seems like we're becoming active investors with this data, and I want to make sure that if we go that way, we're not going in such a fashion that we're gonna chase the
yield.
Yeah.
Timing.
Yeah, the timing.
Yeah.
So I'm worried about that, but I mean, this is what we hired you for. This is what we're
right.
looking for, and so there, you need to know where I stand. With
yeah,
all that.
Maybe just the way I would characterize this is the bulk of this report is your speedometer. You know how to use it. It's your primary piece of information you're getting off the dashboard. When you go to the back of this, now you're looking at oil pressure and engine temperature. Does that dictate how you drive the car? No. Does it dictate how fast you go? No. Should you be aware that they're in a normal range? Yes. So this is additional information that might cause you to tweak what you're doing, but shouldn't be the
But not a major change.
Yeah.
That's what I'm, okay.
I'd offer maybe a different insight onto, or a different angle on that response would be, I think what one of the lessons learned coming out of 08-09 was that a number of investors, be it boards or be it personal investors or corporates or what have you, whoever, didn't understand. And when they took a look at their actual economic exposures, it was an aha moment. We don't want to have that. So if this just helps us understand where we are today and we're comfortable with that, fine. You know, right now, looking at chart 9 and saying we're overweight equity exposure and we're underweight inflation exposure, yeah. That makes sense to me. And there's a sound story behind why you would do that. So the numbers tying out to the story make good sense to me. If it was the other way around, we might look at it and say, wait a minute, why are we overweight inflation protection? And by the way, we've seen plans like this. Overweight inflation protection, underweight equity exposure. That tells me you're really fearful about economic growth and you're really concerned about inflation, but it doesn't tie that to the story because I'm not seeing any signs of inflation out there. So why are we scared about inflation risk? So this is tying out, and this makes sense to me. Now, as we walk through the asset allocation in a moment, we'll take a look at something that's pretty interesting in that the equity exposure that we have is still the major determinant of the volatility in our portfolio,
mm-hmm.
but it's less than where we had been. And so this process of getting to an FFP kind of mindset helps dial that back a little bit, yeah. and can we be a little bit smarter about it going forward? So.
Yeah, all right.
Ed, you mentioned though earlier, you wanted to share this with us so we get a reaction. You can get a reaction from us how we might use this going forward. Is decision making process? I mean, is that, did I hear that right? Did you want us to?
Oh, I think it's something we want to engage in maybe this summer or sometime. I think we want to spend more time talking about how this report works, why it works that way, how we can use it, and start building in this combination of more education about the report, coupled with goals of the investment program, coupled with individual perspectives and questions.
And that's fine. I'm just curious to know, though, Tim, how will you use this today? I mean, does this inform you what you might do with the managers going forward in the next quarter or 6 months?
Not today. We don't have a specific set of policies around managing to risk.
Okay.
So this, as Ed said, this is a reality check. This is largely in keeping with what we expected to see. I think this is additional information that we need to be aware of. Today, it won't guide decisions necessarily, but we want to have a bigger, robust conversation. I think, you know, we went from an asset-centric asset allocation to a functional approach. And the bridge in there is risk. And we largely leaped past that. And, you know, the time scales are different, right? Functional makes sense over an extremely long period of time. Risk helps you kind of reality check in the meantime there. And so this will be a helpful guide to say, in trying to achieve our functional goals, where are we kind of at today along the way? So this will be a helpful periodic check-in for the trustees, and it's really like, am I in the normal range? If I'm outside the normal range, was that a conscious decision? But, you know, we've got some additional work to do around language and terminology and usage, and this is a different beast here, so.
Okay. And where I was going with this, I'm thinking again later, our next item on the agenda, the diversifying portfolio.
Yeah.
Is this something you would approach with that portfolio to address that maybe we're underweighted in a certain factor or area that we would use that portfolio to offset?
I don't know that this particular approach that Verus has in the report has enough granularity to manage that program. This is index level data.
Right. Yeah.
I think when we get to the risk diversifying program, we're either going to have to take some big picture bets or materially increase the granularity of our data and the frequency with which we look at it.
Thanks.
Okay. Could I use that as a segue to into the next agenda item?
Yeah.
Yes, but I think at this point we probably ought to take a brief intermission break. And,
I have John Wirth. You have 1 minute.
I found that five doesn't work very well. So how about 10 after? 10 after 11.